Hey, good morning. We are in the middle of discussing the proper procedure for taking out garbage. Taking our garbage on Shabbos could be potentially problematic. And again, the question was, are you allowed to move your kitchen garbage pail back and forth, you know, to the counter, to the dining room, in order to throw out the trash to make it easier, or do you have to sort of leave your kitchen garbage pail stationary in the same place that you found it when Shabbos came in? And I actually had this came up on Erev Shabbos, this past Shabbos, where I saw that it was around like 6:15, and my wife took out the garbage from the garbage pail and put in a new garbage bag. And I said, oh my goodness, if I throw something out into this garbage bag now, so then it will transform my garbage pail into a buses for the entire Shabbos. So I quickly took like a little, supermarket bag and I tied it to a cabinet handle. And I said, okay, until Shabbos, all the garbage should go into this bag. So that way the garbage pail will stay pristine for being hashmashos and it won't transform into a buses. Then we forgot the bag on the handle. So it was hanging there, the entire Shabbos long, but luckily the handle didn't become a buses because it was forgotten and it wasn't left there and on purpose, but this was actually practically relevant. There were two other practically relevant cases that came up, relevant to what we learned last week over Shabbos. One of them was that my fill-in bag was on top of my Shabbos talis bag. And so I pulled out the talis bag the same way that one would pull a pugla, right, out of the dust. And even though the tefillin bag, ended up, moving because of that, that was tiltol min atzad, right, letzorech davar hamutter, for the purpose of the talis. And again, that was fully permissible. Yes.
I heard our because there are
Tefillin, there's a machlokas about what exactly their status is with regard to muktzah on Shabbos. There are those who say that they are muktzah for that reason, because we can't wear tefillin on Shabbos. It is a machlokas. Definitely true. And there would probably be an extra factor in my case, right, which is that my tefillin were inside of my talis bag. And even if the tefillin and the tefillin bag are considered klisha malachto le'isser and a basis, but the talis bag is a basis both for the talis and for the tefillin. And its name, talis bag, seems to indicate that it's created, manufactured for the purpose of talises. Indeed, there are some people who keep their tefillin bags outside of their talises, which means that whenever you have a conflict, like between two things, more expensive thing, but which the basis was not manufactured to support, and a less expensive thing, which the basis was manufactured to support, so usually we'll say that the basis takes the status of the thing that it was manufactured to support, and so therefore, theoretically, I might have just been able to pick up my weekday talis bag, because it was really a basis for the talis, and not a basis for the tefillin. Again, that's something that, you could look into a little bit more, but there definitely were other extenuating reasons why it would be permissible, but I just did it with tiltol min atzad. Then there was a third case, which brings us right back to our discussion about taking out the trash, and that is that we were visiting my in-laws, and my children were playing with games downstairs, and my one-year-old discovered the assembly instructions for a Lego set, and he happily chewed parts of it off and ripped other parts of it off, and they were scattered around the floor. And the question is, what is the status? Obviously, the remnants, the larger piece, the 90% of the Lego instructions that remained intact, were not muktzah. They were still functional. They're the type of thing that you would put back into the Lego set. And now you just need a kid who's got a little bit more of a gestalt type of mind to assemble the Lego properly, but still definitely they were usable as a map for how to assemble the Lego. But what about those little crumbs, right, of paper that were lying around the floor? On the one hand, we definitely wanted to be polite and leave a clean basement behind us, but at the same time, nobody uses those crumbs of paper for anything. People just throw them in the trash. Just like in our Gemara, right, the needle without the hole, that even though theoretically, right, you might be able to use it for removing splinters, right, or something along those lines, but everybody just tosses it in the trash. And our Gemara, we saw last Thursday the progression, right, that the Gemara said at first it thought that maybe because it's chazi, right, you know, chazi l'midi, it's suitable for some use, therefore it should not be muktza, but ultimately the Gemara said that because people are zarkam l'beina gutais, they just throw it with the scrap metal, nobody uses a needle once the hole has come off, so therefore those holeless needles are entirely muktza on Shabbos and nothing can be done to save them. And so in this case as well, I was not certain at all that it would be permissible to, you know, for sure you can't move those pieces of paper with your hands. The question would be, would we be allowed to sweep them up with a broom? And that's a more complicated question. That would be tiltum and atzad again, right? Letzorech, what? It's not for the purpose of the papers, and it's not for the purpose of the space. I don't think my in-laws were planning to go downstairs until after Shabbos. It was for the purpose of politeness. We'll come back to that question about how to deal with something which is neither tzorech lufo, right, nor tzorech mekomo, right, but is some other sort of tzorech. We'll talk about that more later in the week, but what's relevant for us now is that those papers were muktza, just like the holeless needle is muktza. So again, I'm just finishing off the last couple of questions on page 4, and then we'll turn to the new page, which is page 5. So again, reviewing the Gemara cites two contradictory sources about the status of a needle that lacks a hole. Again, I don't have that many copies of page 4. Hopefully, they're still floating around from last week, right? But what source indicates that the needle is muktza? So the answer is that there's a Mishnah about Tuma v'Tahara, right, that says that if you have a needle that became Tameh, and then the hole broke off the needle, it becomes Tahar. And what that seems to indicate is that when it was Tameh, it was a Kli, and when something stops being a Kli, it becomes Tahar. So the fact that this needle became Tahar indicates that it's no longer a Kli. And then what's the other indication? The other source seems to say that you can't compare Shabbos to Tumah, even though a holeless needle is not Tameh, but for Shabbos, it still is portable, it still is tiltable, and that's the source that indicates that this needle is not muktza. So Abaye solves the contradiction by saying sometimes yes, sometimes no. He explains that if the needle is missing its hole because the hole has not yet been punched in it, in other words, it's at an earlier stage in its manufacture, so then the needle will be fine, because sometimes people decide to just not punch a hole in the needle and use it for other purposes. However, he says, once the hole has been punched and then it got broken off, nobody saves those type of needles, nobody uses those type of needles, they just toss it into the trash. And so that's according to Abaye when the needle would not be muktza. Now, I believe this is where we got up to. The Rashba adds a second condition. This is question 49. The Rashba adds a second condition. In other words, he says it's not sufficient that everyone just tosses it in the trash in order for this needle to be muktza. There needs to be some other condition which is met. And that other condition, the Rashba says, is that it must be tossed in the trash before Shabbos began. And that goes back to the Chayei Adam that we learned 2 weeks ago, and who says that the purpose of Hilchos Muktza is to ensure that we plan and prepare for Shabbos before Shabbos begins. And therefore, the status of most Muktza things are determined during Bein HaShemashos. So therefore, the Rashba says, if this needle was not Muktza during Bein HaShemashos, in other words, if it was intact during Bein HaShemashos, then it stays non-muktza the entire Shabbos. On the other hand, if it was If it was broken already during the Nashmashos, right? So then, person already before Shabbos was not planning to use it on Shabbos, and therefore it is Muktza for the entirety of Shabbos. And so the Rashba adds on the second condition. Number one, it's got to be something, right, that nobody uses anymore. Everyone throws in the trash. But number two, it must have reached its broken status before Shabbos begins, right? Because otherwise, you're planning to use it on Shabbos. Right, and that planning, right, that you plan, right, should be enough to render it not mukta. Now the Shulchan Aruch rejects the Rashba when it comes to needles, but he accepts the Rashba's ruling when it comes to placemats, machzalot. And basically, the question is, what's the difference between a needle and a machzalis? In other words, the Shulchan Aruch says that if you have a machzalis that was broken before Shabbos and you threw it in the trash, so then it's mukta. But if that machzalis broke on Shabbos, right, then even though, well, I won't say even though, but then it's not mukta, even if you throw it into the trash. And so the question is, what's the difference, right, between a needle and a machzalis? A needle, if it breaks on Shabbos, becomes muktzah right away. A machzalis, if it breaks on Shabbos, doesn't become muktzah right away. What's the difference? The Shulchan Aruch basically says that a needle, that if you take a survey of the population, how many people here save their broken sewing needles? Nobody. Right? So therefore, that is why they become muktzah right away, because nobody saves them. 0% of the population. In contrast, the Shulchan Aruch says, broken placemats, people do save. It's maybe a very small percentage of people, but there is that small percentage, and therefore, he says, they would not necessarily become muktzah, and unless you personally perhaps decided to dispose of them before Shabbos. So that seems to be the ruling of the Shulchan Aruch with respect to placemats, and that brings us to page 5. Okay, so let's get out this sheet over here.
Yeah, they got it.
Oh, everyone has?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh.
So these Piskei Halacha, they have both a Kula and a Chumra side to them. So, for example, the case, right? So the kula, the leniency, right, of these Piskei Halacha is that if these things break on Shabbos, for the Rashba the needle, for the Shulchan Aruch the placemat, if they break on Shabbos, well, they're not mukta, so you're fine. On the other hand, you also have a chumrah, right, which is that if they break on Erev Shabbos and you toss them in the trash, at least when it comes to the placemat, you toss them in the trash, it does become mukta. And Poskim write that disposable utensils and foods are similar to placemats, right? In other words, if I have a disposable cup, right, so then, and I toss it into the trash, then it becomes muktzah as long as I do that before Shabbos. Right? If I take, let's say, a fork and I toss it in the trash, even before Shabbos, it doesn't become muktzah. Anyone know why? No, a metal fork from my Shabbos silverware. Yeah, why doesn't it become mukta?
Because it's been bent to throw.
Give me a better reason.
It's usable.
Give me a better reason.
Did it by accident.
No, if I didn't do it by accident. If you really intend to throw it to the garbage.
The Gemara is thinking like a sociologist right now. Right, so the answer is going to have to appeal to the conduct of most people, exactly.
Most people would take it out of water.
Yes, right. The reason that a fork does not, metal fork, right, doesn't become mukta when you toss it in the trash is because most people, right, will take a metal fork out of the trash, right, and wash it off, and therefore throwing it in the trash does not make it mukta. Plastic cups, right, plastic forks, right, they're lying around, right, they're right next to the sink, right, somebody drank water from it. Sometimes I'll rinse it out, right, and I'll drink water from it again. But once it goes in the trash, nobody takes plastic cups out of the trash in order to recycle them. So therefore, plastic cups, their status will depend. If you once Once you throw it in the trash, it's muktzah. Leave it out of the trash, right? It's not muktzah. The same thing as the placemat, right? You throw it into the trash, right? It becomes muktzah. Don't throw it in the trash yet, so maybe you'll still use at least the greater part of that placemat. And so we have this basic idea that if you have a trash bag, right, that's full of disposed plastic, right, paper utensils, and that trash bag is already in the trash can before Shabbos, well, all of these utensils, despite the fact that they're usable, and despite, right, but nobody's going to use them. Adam zarkan lebein agrutai. So therefore, they are muktzah, and the trash can is a basis, right, for all of them, and remains a basis, right, the entire Shabbos. However, if you've taken the trash out, right, before candle lighting, so then you solve, right, all of these problems. The trash can is empty, not a basis for anything. It's just a regular kli shemalachto le'isser, which you're allowed to move letzorech gufo uletzorech mekomo. And so that's more or less the suggested procedure for taking out the trash before Shabbos. And again, right, it's a little bit tricky. You got to do it on your way to shul. I was never comfortable with that because, like, I'm all dressed in my Shabbos clothes. And here I am taking out the trash. And, like, usually there's not enough time to, like, take out the trash in your weekday clothes and then go back inside and change and then, you know, go to shul, because by then there's already some new trash, right? And not Maris Ayin, just you know, the Gemara says the Godim, right? So Adam, how does it go? Right, Bishel Bahem Kadeva Larabo, right? The clothing that you use while you were cooking, which are all sweated up and perhaps stained, right? You know, Al Yimzig Bahem Kais Larabo, you're not gonna come, right, to the actual dining room table, right? And, you know, the butler is not gonna come in his cooking clothes to pour the wine, right, for his employer. So I always feel that it's the same idea, that I'm not so comfortable taking out the trash in my Shabbos clothing.
Don't feel so bad. Our trash today is cleaner than their food was back then.
Probably. That's pretty good.
And if you're careful, it's not a problem.
No, it's true that that there are ways to take out the trash, you know, without getting dirty. Baruch Hashem, you know, I it's not as if I soil myself every time I take out the trash. But at the same time, it's still like there's this, it's like, what do you call it? A dissonance, right, almost, right, between the state of mind that the Shabbos clothes gets me into, right, and the state of mind that taking out the trash, you know, gets me into, and that makes me a little bit uncomfortable, and sometimes, like, it takes away a little bit from the Ruach HaShabbos. So there, that's a practical dilemma, and on the one hand, you got to take out the trash on the way to shul, right, and on the other hand, like, you know, how exactly does one go about doing that? And so that I have yet to solve. Yes? But the stringency is that if it was already disposed before Bina Shmashos, then it's muksa. Meaning if it was in the garbage before Shabbos began.
That's comparing it to a needle. A needle, according to him, is even before, if you put it before, even after.
Well, let's take a look. I just want to read you this book and not have it. Again, whenever you say something's muktzah, that's what I'm calling the stringency. But I'll read you this book and not have it here.
I was thinking comparison to a needle.
So here's the Shulchan Aruch. This is Simon Shinches. It's your bees. He says, Shiare machzilos, right? The remnants of placemats, right? After one of your kids found a scissor, right? That's high, high up, right? In the cabinet, but he climbed onto a bin, from there onto a chair, and from there onto the counter, right? And, you know, sort of stood on tiptoes and jumped and grabbed the scissor down, right? And then he decided, let's see what we can cut, right? So we've had some interesting, you know, interesting things happen in our family, right? With kids, you know, giving their siblings haircuts. And, we've also had arts and crafts projects with our placemats. Yes, we have had this. And here's what it says. shari machzalo, it's the remnants of place mats, mutar l'taltalam, you are allowed to move them around. The chazei l'chasos bu'tinufa, because you can use them. I don't think we do this anymore with the remnants of place mats to cover up, you know, dirty stuff on the floor. We would sweep it up. But what we would do, I think, is you know, in my house at least, if we have to stamp on like a water bug or something, so like you always need something thick to scrape it up. So I think that I tend to use, like, there's always, you know, stuff lying around that needs to be thrown in the trash, right? So I would use a remnant of a placemat to scoop up a water bug, you know, a dead water bug. So that's that's the modern equivalent, right, of using a piece of of this mat to cover up something dirty on the floor. But if you threw them into the ashba, into the garbage, I mean the old yom from Erev Shabbos already, so then after the Talmud, they're totally mukta, so you can't move them around once Shabbos begins, right, because they become mukta. So you're absolutely right that there are two differences between placemats and these needles, right? Difference number one, right, is that needles automatically become muktzah right away, right? And placemats only become muktzah if they're thrown in the trash. Difference number two is that needles become muktzah even on Shabbos, as opposed to the placemats, I think, which the Shulchan Aruch is going to pass in, will not become muktzah on Shabbos, I think. Although the Shulchan, the Mishnah Berurah here says, I have to check this out. Mishnah Berurah says, Shiari Machzalo, Yishen Nifidu Mina Machzalis Yishana, Bein Shen Nifidu Mina Erev Shabbos, Bein Shen Nifidu Be Shabbos, and even if they came out on Shabbos, they're out of the trash, that they're not Mokza. But in Zrakan La Ashba, the Batla Miyois Oid Kli, so now they're, once you throw them in the garbage, you have made them stop being a Kli, they're not useful anymore. And he doesn't talk here about what happens Shabbos or weekdays. I'm pretty sure that if you threw them in the garbage on Shabbos, that they don't become, they do not become mukta. But I want to double check that. And only on Erev Shabbos if you throw them in the garbage, because he's sort of coming off of the machak case in the Rashba. But one last point that needs to be made is that there are some poskim who say that disposable silverware, disposable utensils, perhaps are like metal utensils. And maybe, right, if you throw them in the garbage, then they don't become mukta, right, even though they're in the garbage. I think it's a little bit shaky, especially nowadays that our culture is such a disposable culture, that maybe whichever Posick wrote this years ago, so there was still a little bit more of a concept, right, of recycling, in the sense that I try to reuse these disposable things as much as possible. Nowadays, I think that when it comes to these disposables, I don't know if someone can contradict me. Right? You contradicted me already on the hammers with the coconuts, right? So I'm welcome, to be contradicted again. In fact, I think it will be a positive sign, right, for our society, that if people would actually take some of these disposables out of the garbage. The only thing I can possibly think of is those sports water bottles. Like you get nowadays the small ones. Now they stop making them sturdy, right? And they make them like really, really cheap. Right, so in addition to that, but all the companies now they're very into being green and environmentally friendly, and it happens to save them money because they use less plastic in the manufacture of the bottles. But when it comes to the bigger bottles, so there the bottles are still much more sturdy, and sometimes you might want to recycle those bottles, right, for a trip or whatever it is. You don't buy them that often, right? Or like, why bother, right, paying another $2 for a tall water bottle when you've got one lying around? But like, someone by accident threw it into the garbage on Erev Shabbos. So there I definitely could hear possibly that somebody would take that type of a water bottle out of the garbage, so it wouldn't become muktzah right away. But like a plastic cup, I'm not really sure that we'd say that about paper plates, certainly not. Yes. So let's figure out. You have a garbage bag.
Same category.
You have a garbage bag, and it's full of things that were thrown out on Erev Shabbos.
Mm-hmm. Food stuff, right.
So if it was thrown out on Shabbos, severe. I'm not. That's why I have to check again. I'm pretty sure that that we say that we're going to accept the Rashba when it comes at least to Machzeles, because some people recycle that. I think they will accept the Rashba for that, and we'll say that it doesn't become Muktza right away on Erev Shabbos. Sorry, if it breaks on Shabbos. Again, the Mishnah Berurah doesn't say it, but I think that the Magen Avraham compares the needles to the Machzeles, so that's why I think that he's accepting the Rashba in that connection. So that I want to double check. But the other big controversy, aside from these plastic, you know, disposables, is food. Right? What's the status of food when you throw it out? I think there's a statistic that, you know, they tell you exactly what percentage of food that's thrown out in America is edible. Some incredibly high percentage, 70%, right? Something like that. Some crazily high percentage, right, of food that's thrown out is actually edible. And so the question becomes, what happens if you throw out edible food, right, on Shabbos? So some people say, look, you know, food, even if nobody recycles it, but like just we're not makabel that, right, as halachis, right? We don't believe that society is so wasteful that, right, it's impossible to come to terms with, so to speak. We like to look at the ideal, right, in man, and not necessarily, right, always at the at the darker sides of human nature. And so perhaps, you know, halakha refuses to come to terms with the fact that that so much food is that people just dispose of so much food. And so we'll say no, food is recyclable, just like metal silverware. Right, so if a person throws out, let's say, a peach, right, you know, that they cut, you know, two slices from the peach and then threw the rest of it, you know, in the trash because it got a little bit mushy, right, because it was left out on the counter, but it's something along those lines, we can't come to terms with the fact that nobody's going to eat this peach. And so we'll say, no, it's like that metal silverware, and it doesn't become muktzah, even though realistically, and no one's going to take it out of the trash once it's soiled, right? So that's also a little bit of a controversy. There are posts who say that if you put, if you threw out edible food in the trash, even from before Shabbos, that food doesn't become muktzah, which means that possibly, right, your a regular trash can is a basis, the davar hamutter and the davar ha'asur. Right? It's a basis, the davar hamutter and the davar ha'asur. Right? There's all sorts of trash and ripped up papers and, you know, shredded plastic cups and bent plastic forks and whatever else, things that are totally unusable in the trash. But there are also things like edible food in the trash, and maybe, right, these plastic, you know, utensils. Also, maybe we can't come to terms with the fact that we dispose of those, you know, so easily as well. And there are those who suggest, therefore, that you can usually assume that your trash can is not a basis, right, for davar ha'asur alone, because many of its contents, right, perhaps cannot become a muktza because they are so recyclable, and as a result, perhaps the trash can is a basis l'davar hamutter as well, and is allowed to be used. So again, you know, it's hard to say, you know, one way or another. Do we follow the real world, right, or do we follow this rosy-eyed, you know, world that we see with our rose-eyed glasses because we just can't come to terms with the wastefulness, right, of society? That's like a toss-up, you know, amongst the poskim. And I think that, again, the recommended procedure is not to look away from the wastefulness of society, but to come to terms with it and to incorporate it into halakha. And that's why, again, it's better to treat, you know, all of the things in the garbage pail as muktza, as long as they were there before Shabbos began, and that's why I make sure to take out the trash right before Bein Hashmashos. Yes?
Such a garbage bag, we get to a fine. If they found recyclables and food in the same bag, you get a fine.
They do.
Not recyclables in the sense of
plastic
forks are supposed to go.
They have to go into the recyclable bin.
Interesting.
Just a warning. I don't leave your can on a day that isn't.
They'll give you a ticket for that.
They'll give you a ticket.
so fast.
Right. Looking for that.
So that might be attached on the next thing I was going to say.
So
basically, there's a halacha that says that food, even when it's no longer fit for human consumption, but if it's fit for animal consumption, so then it's not mukta. So, but that presumes that there's a chance that animals are actually going to eat it. Okay. So I on a number of occasions I discovered that when I put out my trash after 4 p.m., right, the day before collection day, that when I wake up in the morning, the trash bags are full of holes, and presumably it's because some sort of creature detected the edible food inside of it, right, and made holes in the bag in order to eat it. Right, so but now you're telling me that it was probably the trash inspector is going through it to see whether there's... Yeah, they've been very aggressive recently. The way to fight the tickets, by the way, right, is if you get any of those sanitation tickets. I got two of them also. They said that there were papers on the grass in between. So the basic mahalach, I think, is assuming that it's MS, right, is to say, look, you know, I try to keep my property clean. Every day when I come back from Shacharis, I look around, and if there's any junk there, right, I pick it up and put it in the garbage. And then when I come back, you know, from Mincha or from Meyer or whatever it is, right, I also look around and I pick up all the junk. But you know, there are times of day when I'm not home, and there are times of day when I'm not looking out, you know, at my front sidewalk. So if somebody puts trash down on my sidewalk without my knowledge on one of those times of day, what can I do about it? So that I think is generally a winning defense against a sanitation ticket, that as long as a person generally takes care of their property and their sidewalk, and then they just look, I take care of it. And somebody put it when I wasn't able, like I can't be there every single second of the day. I was at work, I was at school, I was wherever I was, right? So then so that would work. What I haven't tried is saying it was Shabbos and the trash is muktzah, so I wasn't able to move it until after Shabbos. I don't think they would buy that, because the judges probably know that you can move it tiltol begufay, with your feet, right? And so, you know, they know that that's not an excuse. Both of the judges that fielded my mail in were, I don't know whether they were from, I can't tell from their names. They both had Jewish names, and one of them was quite alarmed also in his response. So he gave me a whole thing that, you know, he thought that my defense maybe wasn't like such a strong defense because of like this and like that, and then he ended up throwing it out because the sanitation inspector had cited the wrong subparagraph of the relevant law. He had written subparagraph 2, whereas the law was in subparagraph 3, which is a whole you know, thing in jurisprudence. Anyhow, so like obviously, like, you know, at some level, like, he felt that the defense, you know, was acceptable. Anyhow, so.
It's a windy day, and it's not your fault.
I know, but it always has to be prefaced with saying, I always keep my property clean, right, and I make sure to take the proper precautions, right, and this happened, you know, in... Yes, it does have to be true. I mean, like, according to halacha, it has to be true. So, yeah. That is true. Yes. I think you actually have to like check off something that under penalty of whatever you swear, right, that it's true. Okay, so that's that more or less wraps up our discussion about the garbage. We're going to read through the next sugya very, very quickly. It's basically going to be three sugyas before we get back, right, to halacha lemaisa. Let me just quickly go through these two sugyas, and then we'll do scenario 6, and then we'll learn the sugya that's connected with it. Okay, so the next sugya basically is talking about the following. The Gemara, the Pasuk in Parashas Bereishis talks about the creation of Chava. And it says, Vayiven Hashem Elokim es Hatzela Asher lakach min ha'adam li'isha Vayivi eha el ha'adam, that God built the rib that he had taken from man into a woman, and he brought her right to man. And so that's a very interesting verb. The word vayiva means and he built. What that seems to indicate, the Gemara says, is that construction, right, is a malacha not only when it comes to the ground and the earth and adding things, right, to the earth, but construction can also be a malacha when it comes to the human body. In other words, certain types of plastic and, you know, reconstructive surgery, right, might be malachos the oraisa, right, of bone. So that's one discussion that the Gemara has, that there is such a thing as bone the adam. Some people say that if you make a hole, right, in the skin, let's say that there's pus or something along those lines, right, and you want, you know, air to get in and pus to come out or something like that, so possibly that could be a malacha of bona. Also, it's like making a doorway, right, or a window, right, in a room that, you know, previously did not have one, and that would be possibly the malacha of bona.
No.
So again, the practical details that I would reserve for a parak that deals with bone, right, or with machiavipathis or with medicine on Shabbos, there definitely are permissible circumstances when it's allowed to be done. There are permissible ways, right, to do it. But what I'm saying is that theoretically, if one does not take the proper precautions, then one can transgress the malacha of bone, right, even when all he's working with is the human body. The same is true for machiavipathis, that the idea of machiavipathis is bringing something, right, to its peak, right, of perfection, and that too can be transgressed, at least on a drabana level, when it comes to the human body. So for example, there's a Gemara that talks about maybe going to the mikvah for a person who is tamei. It might be a low form of machiavipathis because you're bringing, you know, the human body to a higher level of perfection. The Gemara ultimately, I think, rejects that because it's not so in your face. People might say he was just going to the mikvah in order to cool off, you know, from the hot weather or something along those lines, and therefore, because it's not really clear what his intentions were, right, going into the mikvah, so that would be not necessarily a transgression of this rabbinic machiavipathis. The rabbis may have only been gozer when a person's intentions of fixing himself and raising himself to higher levels of perfection are self-evident to every single onlooker. But again, the idea is definitely true that there is this concept of bone and machiavipathis in the human body, and not simply when it comes to kalim, and not simply when it comes to things that are mechubar lekarka. And for that reason, the Gemara tells us that there is three different cases, right, some of which maybe are mutter, some of others are of which are asur, which are forbidden because they are forms of bona or machiavipathis in the human body. So let's take a look over here. It's Kuf Chaf Gimel Amud Aleph, three lines from the bottom, last word on the line. And I'm going to read it very, very quickly because this is not the muktzah sugya. Asuve Yinuka. Asuve Yinuka, Rashi described, is that when a child emerges from the birth canal, very often the body has to contort or stretch, right, into an unnatural shape in order to make that passage properly. And so very often a baby will come out, and all of the books about pregnancy, so they say, don't worry, if the baby comes out and he's a little bit stretched out, right, or contorted, don't worry about it. It's a natural result of its passage through the birth canal, and usually it goes back to its normal shape after a couple of hours or days or whatever it is. So there was a procedure in the olden days that midwives wanted the baby to go back to its normal shape right away, and so they had a certain way of rubbing the baby so that all of that stretching sort of unstretched and it went back to its normal shape, and that procedure is called asube yinuka. Whether they would rub it or wrap it or something along those lines, it was some sort of a procedure that was designed, right, to take the stretched and contorted body of the newborn and restore it to its normal shape as swiftly as possible. So the Gemara says, Rav Nachman Asir, he says that's forbidden, because that is a form of bone, right, or machiavipathis in the human body. Basically, it looks almost as if the bones are like out of their sockets, and then when you rub the baby, right, and it goes back to its shape, it's almost as if you've screwed the bones, you know, back into their sockets. That's what seems to be happening, and therefore Rav Nachman says that it is asur. Rav Shisha says that it's shari, it's permissible because it's not really putting the bones back into their socket, and it could be that this is something that would happen by itself in the first couple of hours or minutes or whatever it is. Anyhow, and so he says there's no harm done if you do a procedure to hasten it as well. So Rav Nachman says, Minam Yinullah, how can I prove to you that this is forbidden, that even a low level of bona in the human body, right, is still potentially forbidden to Tanan? Because Mishnah says, in osin, apiktoizin, b'Shabbos, you're not allowed to take ipecac syrup or charcoal. Right, on Shabbos, charcoal and ipecac are things that are used to cause people to... Yes, they're used to induce vomiting if children swallow pills that they shouldn't swallow, right, or other poisonous substances. So then the first thing to do is to give them ipecac, right, or charcoal so that they vomit it up, and hopefully that way nothing will be remaining in their stomach, and that can really pretty much solve all the problems right away. Once it stays in the stomach for long enough and begins to be digested and absorbed by the body, then you really have a serious potential emergency on your hands. I had a cousin who was in the hospital once, overnight, because he by accident swallowed some pills that he shouldn't have swallowed. Baruch Hashem, he ended up being okay, but it was very nerve-wracking. And you get ipecac, right, or charcoal, and you give it to them right away, so that solves the problem. Now in this case, the Gemara that says that ein osin apiktoizin, that the Shabbos is not talking about this case of potential emergency and medical danger. Of course, that's pikuach nefesh, and you're for sure allowed to administer these vomit inducers on Shabbos to save a person from danger of poisoning. But in this case, people were doing it for some other reason. I think that this is harks back to the Epicurean philosophers who used to induce vomiting in order to be able to enjoy the pleasures of their meal with more frequency. So if they were full, they couldn't enjoy the meal as much, and so they would induce vomiting, right, and then clear out their mouth, I guess, and then have another full meal. And so I guess that there were some Jewish people who used to do that as well, and they justified it on the grounds that it was Oneg Shabbos to eat more. So the Mishnah says, "Ein osin apiktoizin." Because in B'Shabbos, right, you can't do this on Shabbos. So the question is, formally speaking, right, what is the Isser, right, what is the category, what is the heading, right, that we're going to classify this Isser under? Like, we're not, like, we can't just make up an Isser, right, out of the blue, right? The way that case law works is that if you want to outlaw something, so you need to say that there's a precedent, that it's actually already outlawed, right, by one of the laws that were enacted, right, by Congress. And so the basic heading that Rav Nachman says is falls under is the heading of bona, right, ba'adam or tikkun mana makeh b'patish, right, by a person. In other words, he says, according to your logic, right, you are now in a more perfect state when your stomach is empty, because now you're able, right, to enjoy, right, another meal. Right, when you're full, you're not in as perfect of a state, because now you can't enjoy Shabbos as much. So the Mishnah is saying you're not allowed to take these, charcoal, right, because, right, because you're making yourself more perfect, and that's like a form of makeh b'patish or bona by midrabanan. Rav Nachman says if the charcoal is aser, then massaging the baby to put him back into shape is also aser. They're basically the same level of midrabanan tikkun gavras. I bring up this new is a pasuk, right, that says. Right, Bris Milah is very, very, very complicated. Machlokas of Balamar and the Ramban, and there's a famous medrash about God creating man imperfect and asking us, to have a share, right, in our own, physical perfection. But there's conflicting midrashim also, and so that's a little bit more complicated. On Kuf Bav, the Gemara has a very, very long sugya about it. So that you could spend a month just learning that sugya on daf kufav. So that's Rav Nachman. Rav Sheshe says no, there's a difference. Hasam lav urche. Over there by the apiktosin, he says that it's just abnormal. In other words, there are many other reasons why it's important to outlaw this apoptosis on Shabbos, as opposed to by the baby, right? This is just a normal way. A baby is born and the midwife massages the baby so that it gets back into shape. So because it's a normal thing, then we're not going to consider it, he's a bone, right? But Adam is simply doing something which is done for every single baby, whether it's born during the week, whether it's born on Shabbos. This would not be considered a bone midirabanan, because it's something which is very, very normal and frequent. So then Rosh Hashanah says, you know, Minam Yinala, how do I know? It's from the Mishnah that we started off with, right, 2 weeks ago. He says, Machat Shayad Litol Ba Es HaKoyitz. You're allowed to take a needle in order to remove a splinter on Shabbat. So 1 second, he says, isn't that Bone? If there is a nail in the wall, right, and you pull the nail out, right, so that's either bona or sosa, right, depending on whether by pulling out the nail you're actually improving the house, right, or whether you are actually temporarily making the house less functional, right, depending, right, on where the nail is and what you want to do with that wall, right, but the fact is that pulling out a splinter is like pulling out a nail from the wall. It should be considered a form of bona. Now the body is more perfect, right, because it's not inhabited by a foreign, substance that's causing it pain. And yet, it's permissible. And it's permissible to pull the splinter out. So Rav Sheshe says, if that's permissible, then massaging the baby should also be permissible, because it's not a sufficiently high level of bone. It's urche, that's just the normal thing that's done. Rav Nachman says, Hasam pakid, Pacha, lo pakid, the splinter, the body, they're two separate things. They don't really belong together. And so you're just basically, it's like separating, skimming the oil, right, off of the water. They're not really, you know, in any meaningful way connected. That's why it's allowed. And however, when it comes to the baby, you're basically putting his bone where you want that bone to be for life. At least that's what it looks like. And therefore, he says, that would be a higher level of tikkun gavra than simply removing a splinter. Again, we're going to try to move through the sugyas quickly. The next Mishnah and Gemara, very, very short, they deal with the following question. Again, keep back in mind, we were talking about kalim. If something can become tamei, that means it's a kli. If something is not tamei, if it loses its tumah, if it can't become tamei, it means that it's not a kli. So the Gemara says, 1 second. In the halachos of tumah, there's this interesting halacha that says a challah board or a wooden a challah board, right? Like a wooden challah board, right? Because it's flat and does not have a base kibul, right? It's not capable of holding liquids the way that a bowl, right? Or even most plates right nowadays are capable of holding liquid. Right? The challah board is flat, right? And it's called therefore pshutei clay ace, a flat wooden kli, and it's not makabel tumah. That's the halacha. A challah board, right, it's flat, if it doesn't have a rim, it's not makabel tumah, because it's pshutei kli ace. So the Gemara says, wait, maybe that means that it's not a kli for the purposes of mukta, and so therefore it should be mukta, unless you specifically designate, right, this challah board I'm going to use for Shabbos, which is normal. But if you have, let's say, a cutting board, right, that you don't usually use on Shabbos, and it's made out of wood and it's flat, kli, right, if it's a kli, it's automatically designated, but it's not makabel tumah. So maybe it's not a kli. So maybe you would have to designate that wooden, cutting board, right, for use on Shabbos. That's going to be the Gemara's question, okay? For tumah, it seems to be that it's not a kli, so maybe for mukta, it should also not be a kli, and it should need to be designated if you want to use it on Shabbos. And the Gemara's example is not a cutting board, but rather it is a sort of straw that was used, a very, very firm and long straw that was used for stirring olives around when turning them into olive oil. And so the Gemara basically, the Mishnah says, Kone shalzeisim, this straw that's used for olives, in yesh kesher berosho, if there is a blockage, a knot, at the top of this straw, so then mekabel tumah. It's mekabel tumah because I guess that the knot makes it capable of holding, right, some of the liquid, some of the oil that it is inserted into. But im lav, if it doesn't have that nat at the end, then ein mekabel tuma, it cannot become tummy. It's pshutei clay eitz, right? The straw, right? Unlike nowadays, right? Now we're switching over, right, to biodegradable straws, right? So back then, they already had this idea of biodegradable right, straws, right? They were made out of plastic, they were made out of wood, right, or some sort of like bamboo or something along those lines, right? A bamboo, you can imagine a bamboo, straw type of thing, right? So if it's if it doesn't have that knot at the top, so it's incapable of holding liquid, and therefore it's shute kliyeis, it's not mekabel tuma. However, the Mishnah says bein kach ubein kach nital b'shabbos, whether it's mekabel tuma, not mekabel tuma, has a knot, doesn't have a knot, capable of holding liquid, incapable of holding liquid, it is allowed to be moved on Shabbos, this straw that's used for the olive oil. So the Gemara is troubled and says, Amai, why is it that this straw is mekabel tuma pshute klei etzu? Right, this straw is pshute klei etz. It's flat, right? It's not like a bowl or a cup or a spoon or anything like that. Pshute klei etz eino mekabel tuma. And if it's incapable of holding liquid, then it's not mekabel tuma. Just give me a second, my timer. Right? Why is pshute klei etz not mekabel tuma? Because in the parasha of tuma, it says mikol klei this or that or sack. Right, it's like a bag, basically, is a paradigm of something that's made out of plant matter and is mekabel tuma. A bag, right, like a burlap sack, right, is basically the paradigm of plant matter that's mekabel tuma. And so, therefore, the Gemara says that plant matter will only be mekabel tuma if it resembles these burlap sacks. In other words, dumya the sack ba'inam. We need, in order for something to become tame, it must be similar to the sack. And a straw is not similar to a sack, because a sack is able to hold things, and a straw is not. Tana Mishmei Rav Nechemya, B'shah Shem Mehapich B'zeisim, right, but when you have that straw that has a knot at the top, so that straw is capable of holding things, and it's used for holding things, because Rav Nechemya says, when you stir around the olives inside of that bin, the shoshim ha'pech b'zeisim hoko, you sometimes will pull out, right, the other end of the straw, viroebo, and you look to see whether the olive oil is ready, right, and that knot at the head of the straw allows some oil to pool inside of the straw head. So therefore it is a receptacle, it is not the pshute klei etz, it's something that more similarly resembles a sack, right, or a bowl or a spoon or something like that, because the knot enables it and it's actually used for holding liquid. Okay, yes. Well, why is a straw not mekabel tuma nowadays? Well, I think the reason a straw would not be mekabel tuma nowadays is not because of pshute klei etz. Right? I think we say that plastic is not mekabel tuma for other reasons, because maybe it's made out of dust, right? And it is a klei. We have to research why plastic is not mekabel tuma. If the chisaron, right, in a plastic straw is that it is pshute klei etz, then I agree that perhaps in a straw. If you pour,
most of the matter is, if you take any round, like they use in the lab, and they specifically use, they cover it with the thumb in order to pull out. So yeah. You can, in theory, any kind of straw, any material, has a best kibbutz, because that's how they use it. You pick it up and you put your time in order that the liquid will not come out.
It's like the Brisker Rav store. That they said to the Brisker Rav, why don't we make cups like this? Right, so Rav Chaim wanted to show off how smart he was. Right, so he held his hand upside down. Why don't they make cups like this? So all the rabbanim said, because all the water would fall out. Right, and the Brisker Rav, said it's because you couldn't get any water into it. Right, so I don't really think you need to hold your thumb over here in order to get the water. If you really wanted to say, you have a straw, you hold your thumb underneath it, and then it's able to hold It's able to hold liquid. Right? But the fact is that it's not capable of independently holding liquid. I think that's kind of what we mean. What Mr. Berkowitz is saying is that the modern straws, because they bend, right, so you could theoretically bend them into a V shape, right, and then they can hold liquid, right, in the crook of the V, as opposed to a bamboo straw, right, which if you bent it into a V shape, it would crack. And the water will come out. So no matter how you hold it, right, the water is either going to spill out of the lower end, you know, this side, or the lower end on this side, and there's no way that it's going to hold water, right, at all. So you definitely could make that argument that a modern straw, because of its flexibility, right, might be considered a cleave. There's big discussions again with reference to Netilas Yadayim, right? So the question is the faucet of a sink considered to be a cleave or not? And one of the issues is the faucet of the sink capable of holding water? So some people say, of course, right, because you know that the water basically goes up until the aerator, right, and just it stops at the aerator. So there's tons of water that are held in the faucets and the pipes, you know, that back them up. But there's others who say that it doesn't count, because since it's only holding water together with the water pressure, right, or together with the plumbing system, so therefore it's not considered to be a kli, because a kli must be able to hold water independently. And I think that's actually how we paskin, that if a faucet, right, is so small that it cannot alone hold, you know, the necessary shiur for netila sidayim, so then it for sure then we'd be very, very, very hesitant to give a heter even b'shas hadchak. But if you have a faucet that is one of those curved faucets that hangs down, and so maybe you can hold the requisite shear just in the space between, right, the lowest point of the faucet and the bend, right, so then perhaps we'd be a little bit more lenient, because that type of faucet is capable of holding independently that necessary shear for an atilas dime. Again, right, we generally discourage people from washing with faucets because there's other problems with washing from a faucet. But again, you have this idea that in order to fully be a kli, it needs to be something which is capable independently, right, of holding water. If it's dependent on something else, on the water pressure, on the pipes behind it, and on a person's finger, so that might not count. Again, the straw with the knot in it is capable independently of holding the olive oil, so therefore it is considered to be a kli, and not just a kli, but a kli kibul, right, like a sack. However, if the straw does not have the knot, even though you could put your hand underneath the straw, right, and then theoretically use that to transport water, but since it's incapable of independently transporting the water, I think we would still consider it to be not a kli kibul, and maybe not a kli at all. But again, for the purposes of mukta, right, whether it's a kli kibul or not a kli kibul, right, it still is a kli, and it is movable. Yes? Mr. Weiss? No? No question? Okay, so let's... Yes?
The morning before, we had an argument about the question of a broken knee. Mm-hmm. Broken knee, when we bring it a raya from someone brings a raya from a Mishnah, that broken needle is not in the Kabbalah Sunnah. It loses it.
Yes.
And so the Rabbi says, you ask for the Shabbos, but couldn't you bring your rye from this Mishnah that Tumah and Shabbos have nothing to do with each other? Or at least don't have anything to do with each other?
Is that what the Mishnah proves? That you can't learn anything from Hilchos Tumah to Hilchos Shabbos?
You can't say that something that is not a kli for Tumah is, but
I definitely hear what you're saying. If you pay attention closely, so the relevant category for Toma on Amud Aleph was Kli Maaseh, mm-hmm. And the relevant category here is Kli Kibul. So within Hilchos Toma, there's some room to talk, meaning when something's not Mekabel Toma, is that a Chisaron in the same Kli, right? Or is it just a Chisaron in something else and its ability to be Mekabel Toma? You could theoretically distinguish between the requirement for Kli Maaseh and the requirement for Kli Kibul, right, in terms of that Chakira, and say that maybe Kli Kibul, right, is simply a Chisaron in its ability to be Mekabel Toma. But Kli Maaseh, right, that may be a Chisaron more in the same Kli. Right? Now, logically, you could have done the other way around, but you could have done this way also, and so that might not have been the best, you know, proof, because we're dealing with two different categories.
Please keep the pages this way now, so we don't have to worry about tomorrow.
Yes.
I just thought of it now, but that's Hashem building something. That's not a person building something. We're a person building something can be something different. Mm-hmm. He doesn't build anything. He just spoke, and then the building happened by speech.
Yeah, Shikalach, have a wonderful day.
Good. Do I get today? Do I get today that I come late? I can't come. It's okay. Keep me in mind. Amen.